listening to the Isaka podcast. I'm your host, Safia Kazi, and in this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Bob Findley, and I'm currently at the InfoSecurity Isaka North America Expo and Conference in New York City. In this episode of the podcast, I'm speaking with Bob about his recent session titled Cyber Attacks on Industrial Technology and SCADA Systems. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bob.
It's a pleasure to be invited. Thank you very much.
All right, so can you tell us a little bit about this huge disaster that happened about 30 years ago that you started your presentation with?
Yeah, so I started off as an industrial control systems programmer, and we weren't very well trained, we didn't have good processes, and we tended to make it up as we go along. And the relevance of that really to today is that's pretty much how it's still done in the modern industrial setting. So what happened was is I did some code which didn't work particularly well, we didn't have a good testing regime, and I installed it live in production. And it fundamentally brought down the systems on the rig when we got there. Once this thing broke down, that led to another one that it was linked to breaking down, which is the fire alarm system. Once the fire alarm system broke down, everybody had to evacuate the rig because that was setting off the alarms and the evacuation alarm. To compound it, at this point, the fire suppressant system went off and flooded the control room with fire suppressant foam. So we didn't have any process for this, but luckily I'd done a backup of the system before I'd got there. So I took the backup, hit the big red button on the wall, and brought the system down, brought it back up with the new code, the old code installed in it, and everything started working again. But it was really sheer luck that I'd done that. And what I was trying to bring home to people there was that the days of being able to wing it in a plant and industrial control systems are gone, because now we're linked to the internet and these sort of failings would get exposed. We can't have systems without security, without disaster recovery, without backups in place. And this means we've opened a big hole to the hackers. And what's happening now is we're seeing this grow exponentially, that they are installing ransomware, they're hacking into the systems, we have employees at different kinds of industries getting into the systems, we have suppliers doing it. It's completely open, and nothing changed in 30 years.
Definitely. So I don't know if you were at the keynote this morning.
I was, yes.
Yeah, so the keynote speaker, for our listeners who may not have been able to catch that, she was talking a lot about how security and technology needs to be made so that it's easy for people. And, you know, think about the humans when you are designing. Now, that kind of presents a challenge, as you've mentioned, because we make things so easy for humans that it's also easy for humans who are acting maliciously and wanting to get into the systems. So how can we balance making sure things are convenient for employees while also making sure that hackers can't easily access these systems?
Yes, so that was a very good keynote, and I enjoyed a point very much. But there has to be a compromise. The issue at the plants was they've made it completely convenient for the people working there because they were living in a false environment before the internet came along that they could do that, and it was very hard to exploit unless you went onto the site. But now I can do it from anywhere in the world. So we're now going to have to roll back in those easy for people systems and make it harder for people to get in. But you can still do this so that it's first time right. And this is what I'm finding a lot of the time, is that we're not building the systems right first time so that it's seamless to people when they get into the systems and operate them. So this is actually the challenge now, to retrofit proper controls that work well for people into industries that have had no control before.
So you work at an organization that's involved with food, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. We make cheese, milk, whey products, as well as some other ingredients as well. We're a general food company, largely based on dairy.
So people might be wondering, why are you and why is your organization susceptible to ransomware? It's not like you have, you know, social security numbers and financial data.
No, and actually that's a very good point. And it's one that many industrial control companies don't entirely understand. But the reason ransomware is particularly chosen by malicious third parties is because they haven't got data on the site. So stealing the data is of no value to them. There's no money going through the site. So any plant system, whether it's a gas plant or an oil refinery or a pharmaceutical plant, it doesn't really matter what. The key thing there is that it's up and running. So ransomware stops you being up and running. Every minute you're not operating, you're losing money. And that is what the hackers know. So they will know that you've got to make a very quick decision as to whether you pay the ransom, because they've got the clock ticking on you from the get-go. It's not even like at home where you could take your time and think about it. This is something that every day could be $1 million down the drain. So you've got to make a decision. if you've got the correct controls in place, of course, such as an offline backup, then you don't have to worry so much about it.
So you shared some kind of disturbing statistics. For example, you said that, I believe it was every plant in Ireland had been attacked.
Yes, I'd say that's probably using a bit of hyperbole there. But in one way or another, they all have been. So if you went and looked at any given firewall, what you would see is that there are constant attacks going on all the time as people probe and trying to get in. What we do know is that a certain amount of them are successful across Ireland and across the world. Ireland wouldn't actually even be the worst by any means. There's many countries with worse statistics than we've got, where the plants are, first of all, they explore what the weaknesses are, then they try and put ransomware in. And I know from my contacts around Europe through Eurocats, and when we have these discussions, they will tell me, yes, their plants have been compromised. So I would say every plant has been attacked, and we don't entirely know because people don't report it, but a big percentage have actually been successfully compromised and either had the backup tape or had to pay the ransomware.
Mm-hmm. So you said that in your experience, you really haven't seen many organizations that have a map of all of their systems before you get it involved with them.
That's right, yes. And this is, I'd almost say this would be standard practice in the world of IT to do a network diagram. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about people coming from a different background. And this is part of the understanding the people you're working with.
Right.
It's the automation guys, they build things to work. And that can be a little bit trial and error, I've noticed, when they're setting up a plant and they have to get it working in the first place. So documenting the configuration isn't top of their priorities. It's time consuming, it's laborious, and in the past they wouldn't have seen the need. But now we need to understand how we set things up and how they're networked so that we can control it. So particularly from the point of view of setting up your firewall correctly, you need to know that you've restricted it to only the traffic that truly needs and is approved to go to it. You can't do that unless you've mapped out the systems in place in the first place.
Yeah, so you talk a lot about the importance of segregating the network. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about why that's so important to do?
Yes, because you've only got two good controls, and one is segregating the network and the other is physically securing the plant. Segregating the network really matters because the actual devices used on a plant, such as the PLCs, the SCADA systems and HMI devices, they aren't built securely in the first place. So quite often they'll come with no encryption, they'll have poor access controls, no logging. It's just the way the manufacturers make them. So if you have to accept that, then what you can do is, if you segregate that off and apply different network controls to that than to your business network, you can at least restrict people getting into those devices in the first place. So that's why good firewall in place, VLANs would be another control you can put in and separate out the equipment on the in the plant. These are very important controls.
And so why is it so important to have a disaster recovery plan in place?
Well, again, this is the very nature of plants. It's quite often you'll only have one production line in place that will make the product. Mm-hmm. This is very common in every industry I've ever worked in. If that production line goes down because one item fails, you need, first of all, to recover that item, and number two, have a plan in place to run the business in the meantime, the business continuity plan. If you don't have a DR plan in place and you're suddenly confronted with having to replace an item of equipment that was last made 20 years ago, you're going to have to scour the earth for a replacement part. And I can actually assure you that eBay has been called into action to go and source this from anywhere in the world, because there are some of these PLCs still out there that are 20, 30 years old. And the spares are randomly distributed everywhere. People haven't got them in storage. But if you've been through the process of setting up a good DR plan, you'll know what your weaknesses are. You'll discuss for each item how you'd recover it. You may have to accept some downtime on a one-off production line, but you can at least reduce the amount of time you're out.
Definitely. So it's interesting that you mention maybe having to go to eBay to buy parts and this importance of physical security. And I think this conference is especially interesting because just next to where all of the information security events are going on, there's a physical security conference.
Yes.
That you can access. And we actually have a lock picking demo here if you want to learn how to pick locks. So why is physical security something that maybe we don't necessarily think about? And what are some of the possible ramifications of overlooking physical security?
So I think that's a good two-part question. The first part is, why aren't we looking at it? And I think we're almost seduced by cybersecurity and the glamour of state hackers trying to get in through sophisticated methods. But that is not the only way to get at the equipment. And good old-fashioned theft of IT or sabotage or just putting a hammer through a screen, that can still bring down a plant. So it's very, very important. The other thing is that because it's often just put in for functionality as well, so we forget about the physical security. And they just want people to come and go. Again, we're almost back to the point of making it for humans. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we're going to have to make some compromises now.
Definitely. And so on that note, you talked about how the number two source of a lot of these issues is employees and
yes.
their physical access. So can you tell us a little bit about what can we do to make sure that the threat isn't coming from inside the plant?
Well, that's first of all, I guess treat your employees very nicely.
Of course, would
be a very good start. But the key thing there is, again, we keep coming back to what the keynote said. How do we make this so that we can function without restricting? But there are some people who don't need to be on the plant floor, for instance, or in certain parts of the plant. And you can actually zone these off and restrict them. So a good example would be the laboratories. In some places, the laboratory is a key part of production. You must test stuff before you can ship it. But why would anybody other than the lab workers ever need to go into that laboratory without permission or without being accompanied? But quite often you'll find everybody can.
Yeah.
And that's a needless risk to take. So I think basically, if you go and look at where people are and what they do, you can give them all the access they need. They wouldn't even notice you've restricted them because they only have to go to the places they go.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it could reduce the amount of damage a rogue employee could ever do to certain areas. You've also more chance of identifying who did it
mm-hmm.
if you have a restricted number of people to start with.
I think it's kind of challenging for people who are working in the cybersecurity or IT role to then work with a completely different department like HR and ensure, you know, make sure that these people only have access to these systems while other people only have access to those systems. What are some of your strategies for, I guess, breaking down these silos and helping cybersecurity professionals make sure that they have an input when it comes to these crucial issues that could bring down systems and plants?
So I would suggest you get everybody in the room. First of all, to get everybody on the same page as to why it matters. So sometimes we found it quite difficult to explain to people why this is important. A lot of people in the business would just see this as mindless bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, if you get everybody in the room and you explain the risk, and you explain how we would like it structured, you get the plant people talking to the HR guys who control the system, and they go, oh, we can set it up that way, we can restrict it the way you need, let's get the list of people. And you just need a little process. It doesn't necessarily even take that long to design it. You might come onto there is that some of these access systems don't lend themselves to this very well, actually. That's possibly another topic for another day.
Okay, and so you also talk about how computer rooms especially, their only purpose should really be to be a computer room.
Yes.
In your experience, is that something that plants are doing, or is this still an area that needs a little bit of work?
No, I found it almost nowhere in my working career have they been completely restricted. We're quite good at it in my current organization now, actually, and it's starting to take traction at some of the older sites as well as we're trying to clear out the rooms. But I have worked in other industries like the airline industry where computers in an airport would be just shoved into a back office. Things like this, very
mm-hmm.
easy to get into
mm-hmm.
those rooms. The same in the oil and gas industry when I worked there is you just wouldn't have it restricted in any way. So you can't have the computer room failing because it is the brains of the operation. If that goes down, your SCADA system goes down, you've lost the plant. So you must treat that as a very precious commodity and have it restricted to only the people who need to be in that room.
Definitely. So what are some of the important SCADA software management systems to consider, and are organizations doing a good job of keeping up with them, or is this still an area for improvement?
I think it's still an area for improvement, actually. We generally find the SCADA manufacturers are definitely improving. But they are now of a mindset that they should be providing it through the cloud.
Mm.
And what I'd prefer is that they actually secured the systems they've developed so
mm-hmm.
far already and have those nicely patched, nicely secured in the first place with encryption, that kind of thing. And then we might discuss how they operated in the cloud. I'm not very keen, neither is NIST, neither are any of the advisory bodies on linking your plant to the cloud.
So I think one of the things that we tend to overlook but is fairly simple is CCTV. Can you tell us about how CCTV can be used for security purposes?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. First of all, your perimeter. You know, a lot of plants will have a good perimeter and you must have CCTV on it. But also in secure areas, you'd want it on doors to, say, computer rooms to see who went into the particularly vulnerable areas, utility rooms, electrical rooms, things like that, the labs. And then another feature of HMI devices is that they're often logged in as generic users. So in certain workplace environments, you can put in CCTV so you can see exactly who has done something on that HMI at a certain time. So that's very important. The problem with this has often been is that with the CCTV systems, again, these have often been made for convenience sake rather than secured. So sometimes you can get into them through the internet, sometimes you can get into them on site, through a browser or through your own business network, or sometimes you can just walk up to the machine and switch it off. So it's important to keep it secure because it's a very important control in addition to all the other controls on site.
And can you talk a little bit about third-party access and what should or shouldn't be expected of third parties?
Well, I'm a big believer in, first of all, make sure they've got a contract. This is really important because they won't behave in any way that is not contracted. There's a lot of faith in the plants, in their third parties, because they often have a personal relationship with them. So needless to say, if that moves into the cloud, I think that relationship will disappear. So you want a cast iron contract in place. The other thing is that quite often where it really matters is when something's gone wrong. If something goes wrong on site, you want a third party who is truly a partner involved in this. So for me, you'd want to know that. You'd want that in the contract, really, that they will be there for you.
Yeah.
A lot of the time they are. We have actually good partners generally in our business, and those people have been there for us. But I couldn't say you could ever guarantee it unless it's actually nailed down. I'd also like things like right to audit and general good compliance with contractual rules in place as well, good metrics, things like this. That might be a bit overkill in some plants, but it's really important to have thought about what your third party does, where they go, what you want them to do, what access you give them.
Right.
You can't just give them the keys and say, best of luck to you.
And so one of the questioners during your question and answer session asked you about the integration with Bluetooth. What are the implications of Bluetooth on some of these systems and devices?
That was a really good question, actually, because we're seeing a lot more of this, of Bluetooth and Wi-Fi enabled devices. And the problem, again, is you ask the question, why have they done that? And they've often done it for the manufacturer's convenience when they maintain it. So they can just come in with their laptop and dial straight into the device. But of course, what they've done is they've now opened you up to another avenue of attack. So how did they secure Bluetooth? Can anybody, just with an iPhone, get in? It was interesting, the gentleman who raised the topic told me that, in fact, you could almost control their equipment through your iPhone.
Wow.
It was that easy. So, and that is my experience as well. Bluetooth in particular is not well controlled and secured. Wi-Fi can be, but sometimes isn't. It's set up to whoever wanted to put it in without any restriction, without any change management. They put it in and are up and running. So you need to go make sure it is heavily restricted, encrypted traffic, doesn't broadcast outside the building.
Right.
That's another thing, very important. If you can go out on the street, and I've done this at previous employers, I've been out on the street with my laptop and been able to get into the Wi-Fi from the road. There's nothing they can do to stop you.
Sure.
So you can pick it up. In the old days, you could actually sniff the traffic and crack the passwords. So, you know, it's always a risk you're running when you start putting things into Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. So your question always is, why am I doing this? Am I consciously making a good business decision because this is going to help us? Or is this just for my supplier's convenience?
I'm curious, are suppliers now doing that just in the name of saying, we have Bluetooth capability, we have Wi-Fi access? And is that, do you think that's potentially the kind of thing where that's going to be the default and it's going to be hard to get your hands on products that don't have those capabilities?
Oh, that is my worry, actually. Yeah, and also worried that they will actually make cloud solutions as well.
Yeah.
Even though we're not actually asking them to. You know, so that is a distinct possibility. If I was doing a little risk assessment looking ahead, Keynote told us to do this.
Right.
Look ahead at the risks coming down the line. Mm-hmm. Could that happen? I think it could. You could certainly see that the main manufacturers of whatever the equipment might be might go, no, this is only operated through the cloud. Now then, once you've done that, who's actually running your plant?
Right, right. And so somebody else asked about if there's an audit program in this space. Is there? And if not, what can our listeners do?
I don't think there is. I could be proven wrong, of course, and I'm absolutely happy for anybody to tell me that. The reason I don't think there is because the technologies vary so much that each one, you have to understand each one deployed. Some plants, it can be almost just one technology does the lot, and others, it can be 20. So you actually have to know what's there and what the weaknesses of each one of them is. Is it Bluetooth enabled or is it not? How is it plugged in? Does it even connect to the network or is it standalone? How do you patch it? How do you put the antivirus on? Does it not have antivirus? Can it not even work? Sometimes they can't even work with antivirus. So that's another thing to take into account. I didn't say that in the presentation. But it's a bottomless pit of questions to ask. So really, that's why there's no program, because you've actually got to go in there as an intelligent auditor and go and ask the questions and understand what is actually happening there. So that's why I don't think there will be a program. There are good standards, though. So NIST, I'll keep coming back to them, they're a really good American organization who actually have good standards that a lot of people follow in the plant world. And they will take you through all the basic controls you need to deploy. If you have that list, it's not a great leap to go and make a audit program based on it.
Mm-hmm. And then is there anything that you didn't have a chance to discuss during your session, or is there anything you want to add for our listeners now?
There's probably a million things I didn't actually get time to present on there, because it's actually a very complicated field, and it does vary by technology and the people using it, and it varies from industry to industry. The best thing I can really say to people is go in with an open mind and start using your training to understand what is here, what are the risks. This is a risk management exercise in the first instance. What you don't want to fall into is becoming a compliance auditor, where you're just looking going, policy says this, because you will not identify the unique risks to that site.
All right, well then I think that's all we have time for. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Isoca podcast. Be sure you're subscribed so you can hear all of our latest offerings.